Thank you very, very much, Rabbi Kelman. Thanks, Shachar, to everybody involved with Torah in Motion, both on the technical end, financial end, the supporters, friends, and all the work that all the good people headed by Rabbi Kelman are doing to create this enormous Kiddush Hashem, this opportunity for people all over the North America and even in Israel to come join together and learn Torah. It's just a fabulous opportunity. Tonight we're going to be speaking about three very important topics regarding the Seder, and two of them at least are going to be focusing on controversy, disputes between, or tensions between what's written in the classical halacha svarim, such as the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah, and the mimetic tradition, the Torah Shebaal Peh, what most people see in their families that has been practiced from generation to generation. And we'll begin tonight speaking about measurements. And I will frame this discussion based on my experience in my own family, my parents, Alehem Shalom, and every year when my mother, or at least when I was, when I started out, learning in yeshiva, my mother would pass out the masa for everybody to eat, and they would be rather small portions of masa, which contrasted very much with what I was told in yeshiva, that we should have a quarter of a matzah, a half of a shmura matzah. I said, look what it says, this is the Mishnah Berurah, the Shulchan Aruch, that you're supposed to have a half a matzah, a quarter of matzah, and meanwhile she would be serving much smaller pieces of matzah. And I asked, why aren't you doing what it says in Mishnah Berurah? And her answer was always, well, this is what my father did, and I do what my father did. Which is Shalav Yichavia Gecha, that's we know in the Torah. If you're not sure about something, do what was done in the previous generations. So what I'd like to do is, I'd like to share with you where I was coming from, and I'm going to bring the support for my mother from a very, very shocking source. So we will begin with presenting a very basic understanding of the halacha svarim view, the kind of approach you would see in a halacha sefer on the laws of Pesach, such as that of Rav Shimon Eider Zatzal, his sefer. I will put it on the screen. The halachas of Pesach from Rabbi Eider, and he basically will tell you to have at least a very minimum a quarter of a hand shmurah matzah, and a half of a hand shmurah matzah would be better to have for your kezayis when you have a motzi matzah. Now, what's the basis for this? The basis in the Shulchan Aruch that states in Orach Chaim, Simen Tav Pei Vav, which is 46, Shulchan Aruch says as follows. Says that a kezayis is the equivalent of a chatzi beitza, of a half an egg. And an average egg will displace 1.87 fluid ounces, and half an egg will displace 0.93 fluid ounces. Approximately one quarter of a hand shmurah matzah will displace 0.93 fluid ounces. Okay, so if we work with the kezayis, what the Gemara says in order to be yosei, the mitzvah of achilas matzah on the night of the Seder, that one is obligated to have a kezayis, in order to fulfill that mitzvah, it seems, according to Shulchan Aruch, you have to have the same amount of matzah that would, the same amount of water that a half an egg would displace. And that would be approximately a quarter of a hand shmurah matzah. And that's where Rabbi Eider is coming from. So fine. So that's a quarter of a hand shmurah matzah. Where does a hand shmurah matzah, where does that come from? So that comes from as follows. The Mishnah Berurah quotes an astounding opinion from one of the great halachic authorities of the 18th century, and that was Rav Yecheskel Lando, the author of Shas and Shuvos Noda B'Yehuda. And the Noda B'Yehuda comes up with a shocking view. He believes in conduct on experiments based on various sources in the Gemara, that today the eggs in his day in the 18th century are actually half the size of the eggs, half the size that eggs were in the time of the Gemara, in the time of Chazal. And this view therefore believes that two of our eggs are the equivalent of one egg of the Gemara. And so according to this, if you were able to, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of matzah, yeah, the kezayis basically would have to be an egg. Because when the Shulchan Aruch says the kezayis is a half an egg, that means a half of a Talmudic egg. But if you say that our, like the Nodeb Yehuda, that our egg, the half the size they were in the time of the Gemara, so then the kezayis would have to be an entire egg. So therefore, according to the Rav Cheska Landau, you'd have to have the matzah would have to be able to displace the same amount of water that a full egg would be able to displace, and that is 1.87 fluid ounces. And therefore you have to have approximately half of a Hanshmura matzah in order to fill the mitzvah of the kezayis. That is if you agree with Rav Yechezkel Landau. Okay, I'm going to take a look at the comments. Okay, what about humans? Did they change or only the eggs? Okay, so that's the note of Yehuda, argues that the humans are the same, but they are, the eggs change, but the human size remains the same, right? But a scientist published an article demonstrating that kazetim today are right. Like people are actually bigger. Okay, interesting point. I've heard points that perhaps Nodeb Yehuda was a support evolution. Okay, that's interesting. Perhaps it would support that people are eating better today, so therefore more advanced agricultural methods, so maybe that's why they're bigger. Okay, it's interesting, very, very interesting point. And so the question is the opinion of Rabbi Cheska Landau, is it accepted by the classical halachic authorities? Now, you're mentioning that scientists today are questioning it. Well, it's not just scientists today question it, but many of the classical halachic authorities did not go along with Rav Yechezkel Landau's view. Some did, like the Chassam Sofer. Others, like the Aruch HaShulchan, don't agree with Rav Yechezkel Landau. Especially, it's not surprising the Aruch HaShulchan does not buy the opinion of Rav Yechezkel Landau, because the Aruch HaShulchan is very much a supporter of the mimetic tradition, of the traditions that have passed on from generation to generation, of children doing what they saw their parents do. And the Rabbi Landau's view does not accord with the common practice in families. So the Mishnah Berurah comes up with the following compromise. He actually cites the Shaarei Teshuvah and makes the following compromise: that when should we follow the opinion of Rabbi Landau? When it comes to Torah laws, when it comes to rabbinic laws, to Dinei Darbanan, that we don't have to be machmir like Rabbi Cheska Landau. So that's why, as you'll see in a book such as Show and Tell, Rabbi Eider's book, he will tell you that you should have a half of a shmur matzah would be for motzi matzah, since motzi matzah is a din doraisa, and for korech is only zechel miglish kehillel, is only drabanan. There you need for your kezayis for korech, 1/4 of a hand shmura matzah would suffice. By the way, for a machine shmura matzah, the size would be a little bit larger. Okay, so this is the opinion. This is the approach of the Mishnah Berurah as presented by Rabbi Eider. Now, just an interesting point. This question would be: what about, and people have asked, what about Yom Tov Sheni? What about the second Seder for those who us who do not have the good fortune to live in Eretz Yisrael? So would we say that since eating matzah on the second night is only a rabbinic law, so perhaps we don't have to accommodate the opinion of Rabbi Cheska Landau, and we'd only have to have 1/4 of a shmurah matzah? So this is a point that actually is made by Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he's cited by Dr. Abraham in his important work, Nishmat Avraham. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, one of the great halachic authorities of the 20th century, he believes that you only have to follow the opinion of Yehuda on the first night of the Seder, but not on the second night of the Seder. The first night of the Seder is Doraisa, the second Seder is only Dorabana. Interesting approach from the from Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. The only thing is that it doesn't seem that the Mishnah Berurah agrees with this approach. It seems that the Mishnah Berurah takes the idea that does not distinguish between the first night and the second night. Why? Because if we're going to start being more lenient about the second night, what are we saying? Already we're saying, yeah, we know this is really not this, the we know there's no suffix, we know for sure this is not really Yom Tov. And by stressing that it's only Darbana and demonstrating it in such a glaring and blatant manner, perhaps that would qualify as a zilzal of Yom Tov Sheni, would be degrading Yom Tov Sheni. And Chazal are very concerned about degrading Yom Tov Sheni. That's why we make all the brachos. We make the bracha on Mar, we make the bracha on Matzah, on Yom Tov Sheni, even though it's only rabbinic. Because we do not want to degrade Yom Tov Sheni, so perhaps if you're following the Mishnah Berurah, that we should try to have the same shiurim on the second night as the first night. Okay, Rabbi Kalman's comment. Interesting, Shlomo Zalman. Yes. Right, I think you're right. I think you are correct, Rabbi Kalman, that all the posts generally assume we treat the second day like the first. Exactly, that's a correct. That with some minor exceptions, such as actually medicines. Medicines would be mutter, even though normally it's better not to take medicines. On Shabbos and Yom Tov, Yom Tov Sheni would actually be fine, right? That's a good point. Yeshkoch, Rabbi Kalman. Okay. So this was the basis. This was my side. This is why I always, every year, would say, or well, before I became a little bit smarter and realized the basis of my mother, and realized that I should respect family traditions, I always said to my mom, Mom, you should be eating more, based on the Shulchan Aruch, Mishnah Berurah, Nodav Yehuda, etc. But then, a few years ago, I came across a sefer that came out. I will show it on the screen. It's called The Halachos of Kazayis. It's written by Rabbi Bodner from Lakewood. Not particularly known for lenient opinions, but for kulas. But in any case, interesting sefer, the Kazai sefer. And as I was reading the beginning of the sefer, they have a letter published by one of the great halachic authorities of our day, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, from Bnei Brak. No lenient authority by any stretch of imagination. And he quotes his famous uncle, the Chazon Ish. And you're not going to believe what he quotes the Chazon Ish saying. I'll quote. I'll read it to you in Hebrew in case you question my source. Svira Leila Chazon Ish, Timikra Din, the Chazon Ish, the famous Chazon Ish, who was, we spoke about him in Son Rosh Hashanah. He was against using the electricity in Israel that was produced on Shabbos. Right, on Shabbos, he thought you can't use the electricity. Chazon Ish is pretty strict. And he was the one famous saying you should have large shiurim. What does he say about a Kazayas? He says, Mikra Din, essentially, Misha'arin b'kazayis shel zmanenu. That he based himself on the Chuvas HaGaonim, based himself on Rav Chaim V'Volozhin, that the kazayis is determined by the kazayis of your time, of each generation's time. So yes, in the Shulchan Aruch, a kazayis was the size of a half of an egg. But in each generation, you had judged the kazayis by the size of the kazayis of its time. So therefore, a kazayis half an egg. And in fact, because that just in terms of the fluid ounces, the olive is one-fifth of a fluid ounce. One-fifth. So that would be about a kazayis, even not according to the Nodav Yehuda, one-fourth of the traditional kazayis as presented by the, if you're following the Shulchan Aruch. According to Shulchan Aruch, it's point, that which displaces 0.93 fluid ounces, and according to the and according to the Chazon Ish, 0.2 fluid ounces. It's 1/8 of the Nodav Yehuda, which is remarkable. And I'll give you an approximation. It would seem to me that according to this, that what is essentially what does the Chazon Ish believe that what is the Kazayis? Kazayis would be about 116 and Shmarmasa. That's what, that was my, what my mom was doing. And I, as soon as I read this, I couldn't believe it. I like calling out to my mother, Alei HaShalom, and saying, Ma, you were right. I didn't, you were based on the Chazon Ish. Okay, fine. So I was following the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah. But this is the Chazon Ish. Now, I didn't find too many people supporting Chazon Ish, but nevertheless, I was just so shocked. The Chazon Ish supporting the Maimonic tradition, the tradition that that my mother was following, Midor, Midor Lador. So everyone, it would seem to me, that we can all live, everyone can live in harmony with each other. We can have the, we can have Masoret, right, the Maimonic tradition, families, one generation after one generation. Okay, we could also, those who want to eat more, also have the point. There is a benefit of eating more mass. There's no downside to it, at least no halachic downside to it, and that's as follows. If you look in the Rambam, the Rambam writes that on the night of the 15th, there's an obligation to eat matzah. And he writes, when we show al kizayis, once you eat the size of an olive of matzah, yasai de chavato. You have fulfilled your obligation. In other words, it would be, and suffice to have the kizayis. The Nitziv, one of the great halachic authorities from the 19th century, he believed, he infers in the Rambam that when you have a kizayis of matzah, your yotzei, that's sufficient. But the more matzah you eat beyond the kizayis, the more mitzvah you are. Each piece of matzah you're eating beyond the kizayis would be fulfilling more mitzvah. So therefore, it would seem that one can say regarding matzah, that the more matzah, therefore, halachically, it would be having more matzah. The only thing is, no, a fight is not in place. No reason for fights, because that's an issur d'oraisa, lo yechakar chadaso. We shouldn't have like Korach would fight, who made fights. So we should be peace should reign. Okay, so Adkan for the first part of our shiur. We divided this into a triple header, as Rabbi Kellum pointed out. We just measurements. Now let's talk about medicine. Medicines. I just was very happily okay. Well, Altir Gaz, right. That's right. Let's now, okay, do we have any more comments that anybody wants to add before I move on to the next section? Oh, I see a comment. Okay. How often does the shiur anything besides tzedakah praiseworthy to exceed? Ooh, that's an interesting, I would say that matzah seems to be the exception to the rule. This formulation the Rambam has regarding matzah is rare. And normally, right, normally you would say, normally too much is not necessarily better. And actually, by tzedakah, there's a limit. You're not supposed to give more than 20% of your assets to tzedakah. So, interesting observation. Okay, Rabbi Hershel Shachter told us that his father-in-law was at I say it was for the Rashid and they shared one Shmarmasa. Wow. Okay. Gmil Chassadim has no Shir. Okay, that's good. Very good. Very, very good. Nice. Very nice. Okay. Now let's continue let's actually begin the second topic. Okay, medicines. I was happily surprised from the OU regarding rules for Pesach, that they said that pills are inedible, and therefore there's no concern for chametz, since they're for any pills. So, for example, lactate pills. And this actually was somewhat of a turn. That's not the position that they took, and certainly not that are printed over the years from the Star K and other rabbanim and other organizations that say which medicines have chametz, which medicines don't have chametz, which to avoid. This day, period, that chewables are a concern, but if they and there's no concern for chametz. So I was very, very pleased with this, and I was a little bit shocked. And talk about my medic tradition. At least this would seem to be that this is a tradition that a lot of people followed. Right, Peter. Yeah, I'm sorry. Just gonna jump back to the PD. Perhaps what you're saying is correct, Peter. Okay, let me try to. Let's see if we can hold off the questions till we finish the particular section. Now, you have here in the Shulchan Aruch tells us the following halacha regarding says that chametz that lekelev, if a dog wouldn't eat it, right, then there is mutzil time of Pesach. You're allowed to have it around the house for on Pesach. Okay. Not supposed to eat it, because if you eat it, what you've done is you are achshavei. You have upgraded it, so to speak. You have you've dignified it. You said that, hey, this is something you can eat. It's forbidden to eat something chametz, even though it is inedible. Well, it's not even edible by the standards of a dog. Okay, let's see an actual example of this. An example of this in the Shulchan Aruch is a startling example. And that is, it says that dyo, if there's ink that is cooked in barley beer, you're allowed to write with it on Chol HaMoed Pesach. Unbelievable. Or Erev Pesach. So what do you see here? Why is this allowed? Because since the ink is Eino Ro'eh L'Achilas Kelev, it's not suitable for it's not fit for dog teeth, for canine consumption, and therefore it would be no problem to have this ink in the house. Now the Mishnah Berurah has something startling. He says that this is not, that we're not concerned that maybe you'll be afraid that ink is made out of chametz and you will put the right without intention. So we say that we're not concerned about this. Why? Try to explain what this means. Now, in the in pre-modern times, for whatever reason, if they have a problem with the pen, they'd actually put the quill in their mouth. I mean, to us that seems awful, but apparently in pre-modern times this was done, as is apparent from the Mishnah Berurah. Now, the Mishnah Berurah says there's no concern for putting the quill in your mouth, even though that means that you're going to actually be consuming some of that ink. But didn't we just say before you can't eat something even if it is roi lachilas, even if it's not roi lachilas kelas? How in the world can it be permitted to eat if it is if there's this rule of achshavei, you can't eat something even if it is not fit for canine consumption? The Mishnah Berurah explains, since your intention is not to eat, since your intention is just whatever, to fix the quill, ein kapeda, the rule of the rabbinic rule of achshavei does not apply. Okay? Now, getting an exciting application of this Mishnah Berurah that I've seen in some of the Shas and Shubos. They want to point out that based on this halacha in the Mishnah Berurah, that one would actually be able to use toothpaste on Pesach, even if that toothpaste contains chametz. Why would that be allowed? Because even though you're putting that chametz in your mouth, your intention is not to consume it, and since your intention is not to consume it, then there's the rule of achshavei doesn't apply. The rule of achshavei is you're not allowed to eat chametz that is unfit for canine consumption. That's when your intention is to eat it. but here by the ink, or by, in our case today, by the toothpaste, there should be no problem. There should be no problems since your intention is not to consume it. And similarly, Rav Moshe Feinstein gives the following pshat. He rules that this rule of Afshavi doesn't apply by medicine. That even though, again, even something's not fit for canine consumption, you can't eat it rabbinically. It's forbidden. But Rav Moshe adds that if your intention is not to eat it, but it's just taken for medicine, the prohibition of Afshavi does not apply, and therefore you are able to have inedible medicines that are not fit for human consumption. Okay, that's the opinion of the Igros Moshe, which seems that the OU's ruling is a slam dunk. It follows Mishnah Brura. It follows the Shas and Shuvos Igros Moshe. It seems just slam dunk that they have a very big basis. I'm gonna respond to the points that our friends have made, and then I'm just gonna, in all fairness, I always like to present both sides of the coin. I'd like to present why the needs for these lists, and for two approaches, two reasons that are offered by Poskin. Let's first take a look at comments. So Rabbi Callan points out Kavu Chomer, then Minosh Kavu Chomer, when does need an action for laundry detergent, soap, and the like, right? That's correct. It would seem that the laundry detergent, soap, and etc., or shampoo, is the same thing as the ink that was cooked in barley beer. Right? It seems to be the same exact thing. Right? But we will, however, give a base. Right? To Pshita. Right? You okay, Sim? You said you passed in 30 years ago that medicine is okay, but right, a few people listen. Okay. I hear you. It's just seems to be from the Shulchan Aruch straight out, and it's hey, I'm happy to hear that. Oh, you actually, I think the first people that broke the ice and adopted the more lenient approach was the CRC, was the Chicago Rabbinical Council. So, in my humble opinion, yes, call to them. Now, let's take a look. However, let's take a look at the other side. The other side, okay, those who are more machmir, note that the Shagas Aye in Siman Ayin Dalet says that the prohibition of Akshavay, the rabbinic prohibition of Akshavay, applies even by medicines. Okay? So since in general, the other side would argue, since in general, on Pesach, that we are very, very machmir, the Torah itself is machmir about chametz. You can't eat it, you can't have benefit from it, you can't own it. So a little more machmir than we would normally be about a variety of items. And so similarly here, people make the list of which inedible medicines contain chametz and which don't, right, in order to be able to accommodate the more strict view of the Shagas Aryeh. The other concern is that of Rav Gedalia Felder, actually very appropriate to quote from Rav Gedalia Felder, being he was a very, very great Rav who lived in Toronto, right? So being that E-Team is Toronto-based, big schuss to quote Rav Felder. This is the first time Rav Felder is being quoted on E-Team? I can't believe it. That's the first time. He must be being quoted a lot.
I don't know, but
not sure. Check the archive.
It's nice to quote him.
Yes. You know him? Did you know Rav Felder?
He was extremely close with our family, actually. He lived in my father's home for 2 years. When he came to Toronto, when he arrived as a young, really, you know, as a teenager in Canada, he stayed at my father's home. And he taught my father Hilchot Tefillin for his bar mitzvah, and him and my uncle got smicha at the same time from Rabbi Price in Toronto. So we have a long-term connection with him.
So Baruch Hashem, I was with a schuss and I to quote from Rav Gedalia Felder, that's all. Rav Gedalia Felder tried to support the more strict opinion. He pointed out that today the chametz can be, with not such great difficulty, can be chemically reconstituted. So in the time of the Shulchan Aruch, the ink that's cooked in barley beer, that's permitted to keep around the house on Pesach, right? Because it could not be chemically reconstituted into something that's edible. But today we can chemically reconstitute this something that's not fit for canine consumption and render it fit for canine consumption. So therefore, it would seem that this rule is difficult to apply in the Einar Roy L'Chilas Kelis rule would not seem to apply in the modern circumstance. And what is Rav Felder's proof? So the Gemara, from a Gemara in the third paragraph of Ervin, the Gemara in Ervin speaks about what is considered to be Roy L'Chila for the purposes of Master Shani. And one of the things that is considered to be Roy L'Chila is Shked Mamarim, bitter almonds, almonds that are so bitter that you cannot eat them. So if you can't eat them, why is it Roy L'Chila? Why can you buy bitter almonds with Master Shani money? Explain the Gemara, since all you have to do is roast them a little bit, and they will become edible. And so therefore, since with a slight amount of tikkun, of fixing, it can be rendered edible. And therefore, even before they are edible, they are considered to be edible, since they are so easy to be converted into something which is edible, to be upgraded in that manner. And to give a little bit more of a modern example, something that would resonate with us, is it would be the example of spaghetti, raw spaghetti. It's certainly not Roy L'Chilas Kelis. If you put raw spaghetti in a dog's bowl, the dog is not going to eat it. But still, you can't have raw spaghetti around the house. On Pesach, no one can keep that around the house unless they sell it to a non-Jew. But why is that? But it's not suitable for a dog. But the answer is because all you have to do is put it in the boiling water and it'll taste delicious with a slight fixing, so to speak, slight tikkun. The spaghetti is rendered edible. So therefore, even before it's rendered edible, it is considered to be edible since it's so easy to render it edible. So the argument is made, well, since you can chemically reconstitute these items that are presently not suitable for canine consumption, so therefore it's considered to be already fit for human canine consumption, since it can be easily converted into something that is suitable for canine consumption. Okay, that's the argument of Rav Gedalia Felder. Other Rabbanim don't necessarily agree with that, because you can't compare inedible pills, or let's say the laundry detergent, the soap, to the bitter almonds or to raw spaghetti. Raw spaghetti is made to be, is omade, it is, it's, that's what it's there for, to be made into spaghetti by boiling it up. The bitter almonds their purpose is to be, normally this is the norm, to dry it, to roast it and to render it edible, but it's not the normal practice to take shampoo or laundry detergent or cologne and to render it edible and by chemically reconstituting it, and therefore, since it's not omed l'kach, would seem not to be a problem of being roi l'achila. And it would seem that those who adopt the stringent approach regard to pills and to medicines and to cosmetics and to laundry detergent and the like, it's a chumra. And chumra is certainly suitable and appropriate for Pesach. But it would seem that those who want to follow the Mikra Din, those who want to follow the basic law, certainly have every right to do so. We can follow everyone sees that. It seems we have the right to follow the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah as interpreted by many, many Rabbanim. It's interesting that the Shivas Minchas Alazar, that was the Munkach Rebbe, the Minchas Alazar, writes that... That the problem he had in his time, actually it's becoming common today, that you have grain in the gasoline. So even though gasoline obviously is not suitable for canine consumption, but since it can be chemically reconstituted, he said you don't have to worry about that. Essentially, even if generally we're machmir, but here it's what are you going to do? What are you going to do for your cars? And so therefore, we essentially we can follow the opinion of the Minchas HaLazar that we don't have to worry about the potential to chemically reconstitute an item to whether that would consider it suitable for canine consumption due to its potential to be restored. Okay, let me try to have a lot of comments here. All right, let's start with Sim's comment. Pasta is dry food. I hear what you're saying. So in other words, when you're heating up, all you're doing is restoring it to its earlier status. Right, that's correct. Right, you dry it up just so it can be packaged and stored, and then you reconstitute it. And it's made to be, its intention, its purpose is to be reconstituted. It should be more of a problem. Okay. David commented that hummus is the binder in medicines. Okay, very often. Okay, but it's not edible, and therefore that's the basis for those who are for the leading opinion. Lou from Brooklyn. Yes, okay. Do the machmirim differentiate between medicines prescribed for potentially serious medical conditions as opposed to taking self-medications for relatively minor conditions? That's a good question. The way that the machmirim, I don't want to speak for others, but the way that sometimes the Rabbanim couch this is they'll present the, in the books, they'll present the stringent opinion, but they'll say that anyone who has medical concerns should speak to their rabbi, and then the rabbis will be the ones who will take the responsibility to say that someone has a serious medical condition, maybe he can follow the leaning opinions that some Rabbanim, such as actually say Rav Yosef Zal Soloveitchik, that he is quoted as having taken. Okay, what about power? Okay, here you go. All right, Jack from Teaneck is asking an important question. Powdered medicines for children, right? Children's medicine tends to taste good. So chewable medicines would be, if it's chewables, would be more of a problem. Powders, I don't think they are especially I never had laxative, know what it tastes like, but... It seems to me, in my opinion, I'm not saying this is the OU, it seems to be that the powdered medicines should not seem to be a problem. With the chewables that tend to taste good, that's more of a problem, and you have to make sure it doesn't have chametz. Okay, so let's say lactate is the common issue. The lactate comes in a chewable form, and that chewable form actually tastes good. I would stay away from that by all means for Pesach. Okay, David Eisen in Beit Shemesh. The person has a schus to live in Eretz Yisrael, not like us, with a misfortune to live in Chutzart. Does this lenient approach also apply to tasty cough syrup and mouthwash? Okay, I would distinguish between the mouthwash and the tasty cough syrup. Tasty cough syrup should be a problem because you're actually drinking that. But mouthwash seems to be more like the ink that the Shulchan Aruch talks about, that you do not intend to swallow it. But the cough syrup, you intend to swallow it, it tastes good, it's made to taste good. That would seem to be a problem. So if it has glycerin in it, that's really a problem, how to deal with it. If you look in the Star K, in the air bulletin, they'll tell you how to dilute it. There's a way to deal with it. You can't find cough medicine without glycerin. Glycerin is a Suffolk ether. They give you a way to be mavatala, even though you know in a mavatala you're not supposed to nullify prohibited items. Here it's only a suffix prohibited item because maybe the glycerin may come from a trace animal source, and therefore there would be room to be lenient to be mavatala to nullify something a glycerin that is only suffix because maybe it's from an animal source, maybe it's from a plant source. You don't know, even the manufacturers will not know. And about a particular item, specific item, so they'll just make it from whatever is cheaper. So therefore, for glycerin products that taste good, it's more of a problem. Okay, we're now ready to start the third and probably the most controversial of all the topics, and that is inviting non-observant friends and relatives to the Seder if you know they're going to drive. Okay, do we have any more comments on the medicine section before we move on? Any comments? Speak now or hold your peace till the end of this year. Anybody?
Bill, no? Everybody will, type in when they have the questions.
They'll type in when they have the questions. Okay, good. All right, let's start now with a very difficult question. And I know we've been mentioning my mom a lot, so this was always when my family became religious. The question was, you know, do you invite the people who are the family that's not religious and you know they're going to be to or yontif to your house, can you invite them to the Seder? And this year this is a particularly poignant shaila, since Erev Pesach falls on Shabbos. If you can invite them to the first Seder, they're going to be traveling on Shabbos. So are you allowed to invite them to the Seder? So this all revolves around the Isser of Lifnei Iver Lo Tein Michshol. Literally translate, that means we're not supposed to place a stumbling block in front of a blind person. The way that the rabbis interpret this, the rabbis of the Talmud, the Chazal interprets Lifnei Iver to mean not only to not be cruel to the blind person, but also not to cause someone to stumble, to sin, not to give someone bad advice, right? Not to lead someone into a bad situation, either physically or material problems or spiritual problems. One should not cause for somebody else. Right, so what we're going to do about this issue is we're going to present three approaches as to whether inviting these relatives to the Seder, are you violating Lifnei Iver? Are you enabling them to violate Shabbos, to violate Yom Tov? We'll present the opinion of Moshe Feinstein, Rav Moshe Sternbach, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, three great 20th century authorities. Rav Moshe Feinstein was actually asked by a Rav in Detroit. Is anybody here tonight from Detroit? No one from Detroit. The Rav's name is actually Rav Naftali Korbach from Detroit. He was asked this question in 1953. I don't know if this is okay. No one knows this Rav. Okay. In any case, so this Rav from Detroit asked Rav Moshe was, can he invite people to come to Shul on Shabbos if he knows these people are going to be driving to Shul on Shabbos? So Rav Moshe writes, and unbelievably, right, he's very common about this. He says, it's very awesome, it's definitely awesome. And he says, if you know you're inviting someone to come to Shul on Shabbos, and you know they do not live within walking distance of the Shul, and you are inviting them to come, he's telling them to violate Shabbos as Lifnei Iver. And not only is it not Lifnei Iver, Moshe writes something startling. He writes that it's actually Mesis. What's Mesis? Mesis is when you are actually enticing somebody to do an Aveira. Let me try to give you an example to try to help you distinguish between Lifnei Iver and Mesis. Lifnei Iver would be the following situation. Let's say my boss asks me, I have a Jewish boss, not observant, and he asks me to get him, he's hungry for lunch, and he wants a ham sandwich. He says, here, take $10, go to the store downstairs and buy me a ham sandwich. You bring him the ham sandwich, you have violated Lifnei Iver Lo Tein Michshol. Okay, you have enabled him to sin. You brought him this forbidden fruit, you brought him trace food. Right? So Paskin, that's the prohibition of Lifnei Iver. Now, Mesis would be the following. You entice someone to sin. Let's say you go over to the non-observant Jew and you say, you know, ham is very good, it's full of protein, it's low in fat, it's delicious, you should really try, you should really have it. That is Mesis. That's similar to the activities of the Nachash, Akadmoni, of the snake back in Sefer Bereishit. So Moshe writes that by you inviting somebody who's going to drive to shul, and you say, come to shul on Shabbos, says, even your intention is for the good. Your intention is to keep them Jewish, to keep them connected to the community. Nevertheless, Rav Moshe writes, that's not only listening, it's not only listening either, it's Mesis, which is a terrible affair to be compared to the Nachash in Sefer Bereishit. That's pretty serious stuff. Okay? That's the opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein. On the other hand, you find quite a different approach in the Rabbi Kelman. The Ramosh allowed the original Ashkamin so people then can go to work. Right. That's an interesting, yeah. That was a sad, right, in the old days, in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, right. Yep.
I comment, so now, if I may, not just to point that out, but it's, in a sense, a little bit of, you could argue it's a contradiction, because the people said they were coming to shul basically for a 7 o'clock meeting so they could go to work, and here he's saying they can't invite to junior congregation, or I think that was the original shul, if I remember it.
Right, that's correct.
The two tshuvas don't jive well together.
I could see distinguishing between a situation where you open up a hashkafa minyan and you're coming to the hashkafa minyan itself, they're not violating Shabbos. It's just what they're going to do after the hashkafa minyan, as opposed to saying, children, you know, tell your parents to drive you to tell your parents to take you to shul on Shabbos here, and we'll give you a prize. You know, you're basically enticing Jews to violate Shabbos. Because the kids are going to say,
I hear what you're saying. It's a difficult chiluk because in both cases, you're basically encouraging people to come to shul. You're creating a minion so they can go to work. I'm just saying it's hard to distinguish. On the other hand, you can argue, you know,
right.
Once they're in shul, they're in shul. They're not doing anything wrong for both the, you know, in both cases. I hear the chiluk, but I don't see it that well.
Yeah. Okay. I hear. By the way, this Rav Moshe's comment very much has impact in regards to shuls that keep their Orthodox shuls that keep their parking lot open on Shabbos, which is always literally a burning issue in various shuls. Okay, but let's see now the different opinions. Let's see the opinion of Rav Moshe Sternbach. Rav Moshe Sternbach, in his Shuvas Vanagos, very, very interesting series of Shuvas he has in his first volume that's specifically targeted and focused on Bali Shuva. And one of the Shuvas goes as follows. He's asked by a Bali Shuva who has a good relationship with his parents, and he's inviting the parents over for a Friday night meal, and the parents, because he wants to carry the parents, I'm sure, because he wants to have a relationship with the parents, but also he wants his parents, but he couldn't. For that, he could invite them Sunday night. Why does he invite them for Friday night meal? He invites them for Friday night meals because he wants his parents to see Shabbos. He knows his parents are receptive to Shabbos and Torah. So maybe it should be, he wants to know, is it mutter to bring them over? Is it lifnei iver? So Rav Sternbach writes, as long as you've made it clear that you do not approve of them driving on Shabbos, it is not lifnei iver. Because he says, what is lifnei iver? Lifnei iver is when your intention is to harm the person and lead them astray spiritually. However, here, what's your intention? It's not lifnei iver. It's not etzus shein hogen. It's not poor advice. You're actually trying to help them. You're inviting them over to come on Shabbos because of you want them to come to love Shabbos and to want to treasure Shabbos. And therefore, he argues, would not be lifnei iver. Rav Sternbach makes a very interesting analogy. He draws an analogy to chavala, to wounding. Normally there's a prohibition, you're not supposed to hurt somebody, you're not supposed to assault somebody, the Torah prohibits that. However, I'll tell you a story that happened to me this past summer. This past summer, you wouldn't believe what somebody did to me. Somebody actually took a knife, and he opened up my skin, and he was cutting inside the skin, you wouldn't believe it, he was manipulating all kinds of stuff. Now, what am I talking about? I had some minor surgery to me. Did my surgeon violate the Isra of Chavala? He's a nice Jewish man. So maybe I was with his neighbor. I made him violate Chavala by agreeing to the surgery. No. The answer is, that's not Chavala. Chavala is when your intention is to harm. But that's not Chavala when your intention is to help. So too is with his neighbor. Does not apply, argues Rav Sternbach. It's pretty big finish. Says that's a fairly novel approach to say, and it's 180 degree different than Rav Moshe Feinstein. Lifnei iver does not apply if your intention is for the good. Very, very interesting approach. Now the question is can we find a little bit of support for this huge chiddush? So perhaps we could support this from Rabbi Akiva Eiger. The Rabbi Akiva Eiger makes the following point. He suggests, he's not sure, but he suggests that perhaps what you could do a woman could do the following in the following situation. Normally, a woman is allowed to shave her, if a woman has facial hair she wants to remove, she can use a razor. A man cannot. A man is prohibited to shave with a razor, and he's also prohibited to be shaved. So if a man shaves himself, he violates two prohibitions, to shave and be shaved. Now, a woman is not supposed to be shaving a man with a razor because that's lisnayiver. But Rabbi Akiva Eger asks, what if you have a situation where there's a man who's going to shave with a razor anyway? Maybe the woman should actually shave him. Why? Because if the man will shave himself, will violate two prohibitions, to shave and be shaved with a razor. And if the woman does it, then the man only violates the prohibition to be shaved. Right? So according to Rabbi Akiva Eger, or at least his suggestion, perhaps he says, in the midst of the woman would not violate the Ne'ivah because she's reducing Averos. Right? The story goes of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He went, there were Jews who were loading the docks and loading up ships on Shabbos. And he didn't go over them and just say, hey, you got to stop it, you're violating Shabbos. What he did was he first got them to reduce. He said, do the malacha with your left hand instead of your right hand, to reduce it from a Torah prohibition to a rabbinic prohibition. Then he said, have two people doing the same exact, doing work that takes one person to do at the same time, Shnayim Shasu. So further reduced it to a rabbinic prohibition. Then he had them working a few hours less on Shabbos, a few hours less. They slowly, slowly, gradually pushed them in the direction of Shmir Shabbos. So even though he's telling them to violate a rabbinic prohibition by counting with the left hand, nevertheless, Rishon Salanter's intention there was to reduce the averot and therefore would be permitted. Now, what you're raising, Rabbi Kelman, in the note you wrote there, is that Rav Moshe seems to contradict himself. And actually, I was just talking to on Shabbos with somebody, that Rav Moshe seems to take the approach of Rabbi Akiva Eger. Actually, he does quote Rabbi Akiva Eger in this context, because he believes that a frum doctor can switch Shabbos calls with a non-frum doctor. Even though the non-frum doctor is not going to take care to make sure to only do work in the hospital, or on patients, only that which is strictly permitted on Shabbos, he's going to go beyond that. But nevertheless, Rav Moshe says, you are reducing the averos he's going to do, because if he wasn't working in the hospital on Shabbos, if you wouldn't switch rotations with you, then the non-frum guy, what would he do? He would be out on the golf course. He'd be out on the beach. He'd be doing whatever he'd do, all kinds of driving along on I-95 here in New Jersey. He'd be violating all kinds of Isurim far more than he would in the hospital, and therefore he feels that you can, he does allow frum doctors to switch right on to being on call in the hospital with a non-frum Jew because you're reducing the averos, right? But he doesn't say that by the inviting to the shul, right? It also seems to be a little bit of a contradiction, right? I hear you, right? That's a friend of mine, Dr. Howard Affel, also, who was smoothing on Shabbos, he pointed that out. All right, so we have two diametrically opposed views of the Gruz Moshe and of the Chuvas von Huggles. Maybe we can support the Chuvas von Huggles from Rabbi Akiva Eger, from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Let's now conclude our discussion with Sagar Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Shlomo Zalman Orbach pointed to the following two Mishnah in Masechet Shvi'ah. The Mishnah says as follows. Mishnah talking about Shemitah. Up since the Shemitah year, good for us, we'll talk a little bit about Shemitah. The rule is as follows. Let's say if you have a Jew who doesn't keep Shemitah very carefully. We called it that in the Talmud Mishnah, Amar. And you're not allowed to sell him farming equipment that would be used only for the purposes of violating Shemitah. So, for example, you cannot sell Tunama Aretz plowing materials because all plowing is forbidden on Shemitah. However, you can sell the non-observant Jew, the Ama Aretz, you can sell them implements, farming implements that would be used for harvesting since certain harvesting is permitted in Shemitah. Small-scale harvesting is permitted in Shemitah. And more today we say within the context we also are based in, it's mutter. So since, so what's the rule the Mishnah says? The achlal, kol shemalach miyucheret la'avera. If you're selling an item that can be used as only for an avera, it's aser. Isra la'heter, if that item can be used for both isra and heter, it's mutter. So for example, I can sell a pot to a cooking pot to a non-observant Jew, because they can use that cooking pot either to cook eggs, which is permissible, or they could use it to cook Basar Bechala, which is obviously forbidden, but I don't violate Lisnei's, so since the item they sold then can be used either for Isser or for Hesed, that which is prohibited and that which is permissible. Based on this principle that's articulated in the Mishnah in Shviyas, Rishon Zalman Arbach gave the following psak to Yeshivat Ar Samach, and this is actually quite a popular psak, that it's permissible to invite even a person who lives a distance from shul and to come for Shabbos, to come for the tefillah, into the state of beginner services. When would it be allowed? If you offer him a place to sleep, right, close to the place in a way that he won't have to violate Shabbos. So what was Shlomo Zalman? And this is what I would tell my mother when she asked me later on if I got the smicha, how should she handle this issue? So I would say, invite the non-observant relatives and say, come over we invite you to stay over, we'd love you to stay over by our house, by one of our neighbor's houses. So this way you don't have to travel home, and therefore when you're inviting them, you are extending an invitation in a manner that can be used, which would then for violating Shabbos when they would be driving, or they could use it for Isser Leheter, or they could use it, it's something that could be used either Isser Leheter, they could use it either for driving or for sleeping over, not violating Shabbos, and therefore you haven't violated Lisnei Ibir Lo Sitein Mishal. The only thing that I would add to this is just practically what we would try, when we'd handle this in my mother's house, was that in a year like this, we would invite the relatives for the second Seder. Why? Because we didn't want them driving on Shabbos. Even though we were with some of them, but still, that we should be the cause of driving on Shabbos is idea and thought. So we would invite them the second Seder, so they would be driving on Yom Tov and not Shabbos. Yom Tov is certainly terrible to drive on Yom Tov. But it's an Isser Lav, not an Isser Karet. It's a negative prohibition without the at least the theoretical punishment of the death penalty and certainly of Karet. So Yom Tov is not as strict. So therefore, we invited them for the second Seder in a year like this when Erev Pesach falls on Shabbos. And in all other years, we would invite them for the first Seder. Why? Because at least when they would drive up before Yom Tov, and so they would only be violating Shabbos one way, not the other way, and certainly we'd follow Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arbach's approach to offer them hospitality. Okay, so Ad Kan, we've covered three nice topics, especially in this last topic. You have three approaches, and not saying who to follow, but one should ask the Rav whose opinion to follow, Rav Moshe or Sternbach or Shlomo Zalman Arbach. Ah, and to announce everybody that tomorrow you have a very, very nice shiurim. Marsha, what if the Rav will be driving to a different over the first Seder anyway? Right. That's true. In most of these cases, they're going to be driving anyway. Right. So therefore, it wouldn't be listening either. It's not considered to be listening either, because anyway, they're going to be driving. Right. So I know, anyway, they'll be that makes the question harder, because let's say they're going to go to a different home for the first Seder, where they're going to be serving chametz, where they're not going to have the mitzvahs of matzah, they're not going to have the mitzvahs of mar. I know, but it's tough. It's a very tough issue. But on the other hand, by you're inviting them, it's something that, it's already on your shoulders. It's your responsibility. If they go out of a different home, it's already if they're going with different homes, it's not your responsibility. They're coming to your house, it's a little bit more of your responsibility.
Personal Chabad practice, invite people to shul and to seders and everything, whether they drive or not. This is all over the United States and much of the world. I know the shaliach here, the head shaliach in my town, invites people for seder, and people actually drive up since there's very little street parking near his house. They park on his driveway. I'm wondering, I have trouble understanding Rav Sternbach. In many ways, it seems very little different from what the conservatives are doing, though I understand they're saying it's permitted to drive to shul. They don't say it's permitted to drive anyplace else. Aren't they just being more intellectually honest, since the people are going to be driving anyway than the Orthodox shuls that have their parking lot open? I even seen an Orthodox shul where they had to do shiputzim. They had to do construction on their parking lot. So they put out in their bulletin, anyone who's coming with the car, park on the parking lot of the neighbor. We got permission. I don't see how the difference is so hot. It's so clear.
Okay, I'm glad you raised that. The story is tied. I didn't hear this directly, but I heard the Lubavitcher Rebbe made the following comment, that he said that the big mistake that the conservative movement made was they said that something they made a mutter, or they even made a, I don't know if they've done a submissive, but permitting something. First of all, it's the biggest joke in the world to say that you could drive the shul claiming that it's only necessary to abandon on some local and circle gufa, which is not, and claiming shuls for mikdash that rabbinic prohibitions don't apply to a shul, since certain rabbinic prohibitions don't apply to the mikdash. So the permission that they gave was utterly ridiculous. But it's quite another thing where you keep and I'm not necessarily endorsing this, but I'm going to at least just defend the approach of Lubavitch, that basically taking the Rosh Sternbach approach, and those shuls, the Orthodox shuls that keep the parking lot open, they're basically saying, you know, look, our intentions for good, but at least what they're doing is what they're accomplishing is something the conservative movement does not accomplish, and that is what they're not doing is they're not compromising the ideal and the principle. The conservative movement, what they've done is they have compromised the principle, okay? And therefore that's what they've ruined. And Lubavitch do not compromise the principle. Shuls with the parking lot open, they're saying, look, we want you to come, but they're welcoming, but they're not compromising the principle. And the local shliach offers lodging, even when they know that people will refuse. Look, but that's still Rosh Zalman Auerbach's psak. Even though he knows that people are going to refuse, but nevertheless, that would seem, that's what it's a little bit of a chiddush. It would seem perhaps the Mishnah says that you can sell plowing items, you can sell harvesting implements only if it's a possibility to be used either for het or itzah, but if you know for itzah, it wouldn't be permitted. But Ramos Shlomo Zalman Auerbach seems to be taking the lenient approach, even if you know they're going to use it for itzah, for prohibited items, for prohibited purposes, it would still be permissible to sell. Okay, it's a little bit of a chiddush, so it's a little bit more stringent than the shalos and the shuls van hagos. But you have to mean it. You have to really mean that you don't just invite them and it's just a formality. You have to be able to back that up. I would tell you, by the way, personally, in my family, when we make seder in my house, my wife and I decided that we have non-observant relatives not to invite them over for the Siddurim. We thought that would not be a good example for our children to see. So instead, we invite our non-observant relatives to come over for Purim, to come over for Chol Hamoed Sukkos, to sit in the Sukkah, Hanukkah, right? These are, this way you avoid this problem altogether. But again, that's the way we decide in our family. So each family has to figure it out, discuss with their Rav, and do some soul searching, which approach they're going to take to this, to these issues. Okay, any other comments? Thoughts?
Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Yes, thank you so much, David, from Beit Shemesh, for joining us.
In Israel, I imagine it's a little bit less of an issue, somehow.
Why is it less of an issue in Israel?
I would guess, A, people, they don't try. It's different. A, there's only one Seder, of course, but I'd imagine a lot of people would walk. It's different. I don't know. I somehow get the hunch it's different, and David seems to confirm that. But I don't know that. I don't know. With the way Kibbutz works in Israel is slightly different. I would think more secular Israelis would understand they shouldn't drive. In America, they don't even understand you shouldn't drive. like not in the Parsha. Whereas in Israel, people try because they're not from it. If they're going to somebody's house, I think they would be more sensitive to the issue. I could be wrong, but that's my hunch.
I think
David,
also
you can
Israelis,
let me know if my hunch is right.
I think there's another thing. I think Israelis also don't mind sleeping over other people's houses for the most part. They're accustomed to that. They like sleepovers. Americans, people who are not religious, I think, are not observant. They're not so into sleeping over at somebody else's house. They're not used to slumber parties, adult slumber parties like we are.
That's also true, of course.
That's the best part of the fun, you know. Gotta get used to the slumber parties. It's good stuff.
Here you can walk for an hour and a half, you know.
Yeah.
See, if you live in Teaneck, you can't really walk the way. In Toronto, the way the city is set up, you can walk from one end to the other. In Teaneck, it's smaller. You're not going to walk Englewood, so
right.
I'm talking about the firm people
right.
who go to the parents for one, the in-laws for the other.
Right. Very, very good. Yeshkov for everybody for participating. Chakasha Sameach to everybody, to Peter in Berkeley. And Yeshkov to Rabbi Kalman, to all the supporters. Also of your team, a big yashkach to all of you, and a really wonderful Chag Sameach. Let's hope Mashiach should come before this Pesach. We should be able to offer Karban Pesach in the Beit Hamikdash and usher in a time of peace and tranquility. Have a very, very good night, everybody.
Thank you. Okay, Chag Sameach.